From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is Choral Arts Classics. Tonight, a conversation about the future of classical music. The time when the attention of audiences is being pulled in so many different directions. How do choruses, orchestras, opera companies, and other musical institutions remain relevant in their communities? And how do they balance their budgets when the competition for philanthropic and corporate support has never been tougher? What will it take for the next generation of musicians to engage and excite the next generation of listeners? Classical music has always been associated with a somewhat rarefied demographic, from the royal and religious patrons of the Renaissance to the modern industrialists whose name adorned concert halls as a testament to their business success and civic generosity. But in a world where people have virtually unlimited access to music on a device that fits in your pocket, how does the classical music establishment make a compelling argument for people to attend live performances, especially when folks have so many video and audio options for hearing music, options that can be exercised at a time and place that are usually much more convenient for people in their busy and hectic lives? Hello again, and thanks for joining us for Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and the host of Maryland Morning here on 88.1. Glad you could be with us tonight. As we have done for the past 13 years, on the last Tuesday night of the month from September through April, we get together and we listen to and talk about great choral and vocal music, and we sample recordings and live performances of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and our special guests. I appreciate your tuning in and joining us. We're going to do things a little bit differently in tonight's show. We'll hear a little music, of course, but we'll spend most of the hour speaking with two people who wrestle every day with the existential issues around classical music and who have interesting ideas about what it will take to move the art form forward. Fred Bronstein was appointed dean of the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University back in 2014. He's an accomplished pianist and educator, and he came to Baltimore after 6 years at the administrative helm of the St. Louis Symphony. Catherine Dehoney is the president and CEO of Chorus America, the Association of Professional and Volunteer Choruses in the United States and Canada. They'll join me in the studio in just a few minutes. But first, let's start with some music. I'd like to share with you a new piece for chorus and orchestra that the Baltimore Choral Arts Society commissioned as part of this year's celebration of the 50th anniversary. The piece is called Bring On the True Wine, and it was composed by Joshua Bornfield, a very imaginative emerging composer of opera, choral music, and chamber music. Josh is also a very fine singer, and he sings with the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. He was part of the chorus who performed the premiere of this beautiful new work last month in a live concert that we broadcast right here on WYPR. The text is from Horace, the great poet of Roman antiquity. It's about sitting around the fire in fellowship and harmony, and this premiere performance featured the full chorus and orchestra of the Choral Arts Society. I'm conducting music of Josh Bornfield right here on Choral Arts Classics. Music by Joshua Bornfield here on Choral Arts Classics. That was Bring On the True Wine, one of several pieces that we commissioned this season. Baltimore Choral Arts Society is celebrating our 50th anniversary. You heard a live performance recorded last month at the Baltimore Basilica, which featured the full chorus and orchestra of the Choral Arts. I'm Tom Hall, and I conducted that concert. You're listening to Choral Arts Classics here on 88.1 WIPR. It's my pleasure now to welcome two classical music professionals who have experience in the worlds of choral music, orchestral music, and music education. Fred Bronstein is the dean of the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University, and Catherine Dehoney is the president and CEO of Chorus America, the Association of Professional and Volunteer Choruses here in the U.S. and in Canada. They join me in the studio. Good evening and welcome to you both.
Hello.
Good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So, Fred, let's place yourself in this panoply of classical music, because you are now the dean of what I think is the oldest music conservatory in the United States of America.
It is indeed.
But you came here directly from the orchestra world, mm-hmm. and you've been a performer yourself. What were you doing prior to your tenure beginning at Peabody a couple of years ago?
So I was running the St. Louis Symphony, and prior to that, the Dallas Symphony. And I got into the orchestra business a number of years ago, almost by accident. I was playing in a chamber music group for many years, and a group focused on new music, as a matter of fact, and was a touring ensemble. And as I looked down the road, wanted to sort of expand the range of things that I was doing in the music world, and through a story that I won't go into because it's a long story, but found my way into the orchestra business and enjoyed about 18 years in a very rewarding, very challenging, of course, but a fantastic field to have come from. And it's given me, I think, a unique perspective in some sense on the world I'm in now today as we're training the future musicians that are going to end up in the orchestra and other in other venues.
Yeah, and I would imagine that in that experience informs it every breath you take. I mean, because a music conservatory is not like an undergraduate liberal arts college. I mean, you are training people to be musicians.
You are, and I think what's been so interesting for me is to come at it from the perspective of the world of orchestras, which have not been known for being the most innovative. Mm-hmm. However, in the last 20 years have really made strides and really worked to change that. And then coming into the conservatory world and finding that that world is even less innovative. And I think – and recognizing, though, that – and this is where my experience in the orchestra world really does inform it – recognizing that what happens in the professional world today and the world that these folks are going into is so radically different than it was even 20 years ago, let alone 50 or 60 or 70 years ago, that it's so important for us to rethink how we're training our students to be successful in the future. And that just – we talked some about that, but it's a really interesting dynamic and a very important change. And that's why I guess I feel so passionate about what I'm doing now.
Sure. And, of course, all industries probably are, so bound to tradition. And it's interesting that, orchestras in many ways are working exactly the same way they worked 50 years ago. Conservatories are working in very much the same sort of general paradigms as they followed 50 years ago. And in choral music, Catherine Dehoney, mm-hmm. The same could be said of that. I mean, there's a tradition of choral societies and singing mm-hmm. societies in the United States that goes back to the 19th century. Tell us a little bit about Chorus America. And full disclosure, you and I have known each other for a long time. I've mm-hmm. served on the board of Chorus America. I was the chair of that board. I have at certain times in my career been very involved. But what does Chorus America do and who belongs?
Sure. Well, Chorus America is the leadership association for choruses. Pretty much our sweet spot are those choruses that function as nonprofit organizations. So they would like training in fundraising and board governance and marketing and those kinds of things. So our membership tends to be outside of church and school organizations. And we're about 40 years old, believe it or not. And yes, Tom, you were a wonderful chair of our board and helped bring us to where we are today. But you're right about choruses. What we're seeing is just sort of an explosion of choruses, small choruses, kind of a flexible structure that have special missions. We're seeing a lot of that alongside of the long-term classical choruses, the oratorio societies and the choral arts societies and those sort of things. But all of them are looking for different ways to reach these new audiences through music.
Right.
Right. And, of course, that's something that we struggle with at the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Our friends at the Symphony struggle with that. Mm-hmm. Friends from all over the musical spectrum are saying, where is that next audience member?
And that's why it is, one of the first things I said to folks when I got to Peabody was, we're in the audience development business. And I don't know that music schools have ever thought of themselves as being that, but we are. Because if we're going to change future audiences, we have to change the performers that are on the stages of the performing arts organizations. In order to do that, we have to change what we're doing in the conservatory as well.
There's a quote that comes from Time magazine in an article about the music business. This is the lead article about classical music, particularly the orchestras. It's one of my favorite quotes. It says, "As a group, the symphony orchestras in the United States are unsurpassed in quality by those of any other nation in the world. Yet today they are in trouble. Loud, unavoidable, cymbal-crashing financial trouble." This comes from Time magazine, the cover story in June 1969. Hmm.
Yeah,
I was 14 years old and in my second year making a living, at least part-time, as a professional musician. And the people have been calling for the end of the world of classical music for a long time, Fred. What's that all about?
So that's a really great question. I mean, I guess what I would say about it is that I think classical music is here, and I think classical music actually can and will thrive. But I think what it requires is that we rethink a lot of how we are delivering that and reaching audiences and how we interact with audiences. I think for us to not understand that is to risk the assumption that it's going to be the same way it's been for the last 100 years. There are a few businesses that are like that, actually.
Sure.
I would say that, So I think we have to recognize that there are things about it that are changing. It doesn't mean there's not a way to be successful. It doesn't mean that there aren't very successful organizations. And in fact, when I was in the orchestra business, and I still feel this, I think that the it's overstated the trouble that orchestras have. There are many orchestras that are doing very, very well. But I think the ones that are doing well have really rethought the way they see their market, and they're broadened. They may be supporting still their core classical mission, but they've broadened the vision for what they do in the community, in education, in the media, on the concert stage. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what conservatories, that's what we are doing at Peabody now and are working towards, because I think we have to think of ourselves in that same way in terms of the kind of environment that people are going to be going out into. So I'm actually very optimistic about it, but I think it comes with a caveat that you've got to be willing to reimagine what you're doing.
On 88.1, it's Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Fred Bronstein joins us in the studio. He's the dean of the Peabody Conservatory, or the Peabody Institute, rather, of the Johns Hopkins University. Catherine Dehoney is here as well. She's the president and CEO of Chorus America. Catherine, of course, the orchestra world, when folks think about the orchestra world, they tend to think about the professional orchestra world, the big 52-week orchestras like the Baltimore Symphony or the National Symphony in your hometown of Washington. The choral music business, by and large, many of those groups are at least partly volunteer. This organization, Chorus America, began as the Association of Professional Vocal Ensembles back in the day, 40 years ago, and it was organized to state the case for paying singers and for having professional vocal artists be put on the same par as professional instrumentalists who play in symphony orchestras. What's the status of the professional dimension of our art form at this juncture 40 years later?
That's a great question. I feel like it's steady state. What I've seen is the professional choruses in the U.S. tend to be where it's sort of the cutting edge of new choral music and interesting choral music performance. There are very few of them, relatively speaking. There are literally thousands of community choruses where either, they're volunteer in that the singers are giving of their time. They also could have quite proficient singers who probably have music degrees in many, many cases. But the professional choruses tend to be sort of the smaller niche of choral singing. I think what's happening with professional singers is that there are a lot of opportunities for professional singing, and they tend to be flexible. They would need to be able to sing very well in a whole variety of styles, and it opens up possibilities all over the country in terms of being able to join some of these professional choruses or become part of a professional corps in a larger chorus. But the grounding that professional singers have today, I think, has to be very broad and really incredible technique that they can reach down and have great technique in all sorts of different genres.
Yeah, and Fred, of course, you're training vocalists as well as instrumentalists at, right. at the Peabody. And at least up to a few years ago, I don't know what it's like this year or last year, there have been no shortage of people wanting to enter conservatories. There's been no shortage of people interested in a career as a professional musician, be it a instrumentalist or a vocalist, yet we hear all the time about the shrinking pool of available jobs.
Right. I mean, I think people want to study. There are a lot of people that want to study music. I think that's true. Of course, there are more music schools today, too, than there once were more programs. So it's highly, you know, it's competitive among the schools, and the top schools compete for the top students. But I think that, no, people do want to study. And I think, you know, it actually brings up an interesting thing when you were talking about, you know, professionals and amateurs. It made me think of this idea that, you know, I think one of the things is I think about the future of classical music. It's the intersection of professionals with amateurs that I think is so important in terms of getting people interested and interacting, because people want to participate. Mm-hmm. They want to be part of it. I mean, you think of something like right here in Baltimore, of course, the Rusty Musicians Program at the Baltimore Symphony, I think, is a great example of that, where people come play side by side with members of the BSO. They want that kind of experience, that kind of intimacy with performers. And even in the orchestra business, what I learned was that audiences want to be on the inside. They want to get to know the performers. They want to interact with them. They want to know what that experience is like. And I think so creating venues, creating opportunities where people can do that is really important, I think is really meaningful.
All right, well, we'll pick up on this conversation after a break for a little music. We're going to hear some orchestral music. This is the Baltimore Choral Arts Society Orchestra playing a movement from the Simple Symphony by Benjamin Britten. This is the Playful Pizzicato. Music of Britten here on Choral Arts Classics. Thank you. music of Benjamin Britten here on Choral Arts Classics. That was the string section of the Choral Arts Orchestra playing Without Their Bows in that fun little bit from Britten's Simple Symphony. I'm Tom Hall. I conducted that live performance last month at the Baltimore Basilica. Thanks for joining us tonight on Choral Arts Classics here on 88.1. My guests this evening are Catherine Dehoney, the president and CEO of Chorus America, and Dr. Fred Bronstein, the dean of the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University. So, Catherine, are there many people making a living? I mean, it seems to me, I remember when I was a kid in music school, the dream at that point was, can we actually make a living at this? I mean, we started studying, we, you know, learned our instruments, we learned how to sing or conduct or whatever we were going to do. And then the one conversation in all the practice rooms was, you know, do you think we actually get paid for this? How many people are actually getting paid for this and actually supporting themselves as professional singers and professional conductors?
Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I had a number. I know there are many, many conductors out there, but the way they're making their living, and I don't need to tell you this, is piecing it together. And entrepreneurship seems to be the buzzword, and the same for professional singers. It's not just one job. We have a joke, really, about the American Airlines choirs, these wonderful singers who fly to have opportunities to sing with choruses around the country. And so you can do it. And then at the same time, I think what we're seeing is some of these musicians are thinking more broadly and are able to go into the arts administration side, whether formally through arts administration master's programs or whatever, or back through, you know, just because of their love of it, and they come up the way I did, which is, you know, through fundraising or something else, get a specific field under their belts.
And Fred Bronstein, entrepreneurship certainly is the buzzword throughout the music industry, on both the administrative side and the performing side.
You know what's interesting about that, though, when I think about music schools, and this is something that we are working to change here at Peabody, is that schools have approached that whole issue, you know, teaching kids to communicate, teaching them to, you know, to deal with media, teaching them technology. Audience development, they've tended to put that at the periphery of what they do. In other words, if you're interested in it, we'll give you a taste of it. I take the position, we take the position, that that's not really good enough anymore, that it has to be integrated into what the musician is learning as a holistic thing. And it's very difficult because we all know to become an accomplished musician today is as difficult as it ever was. The level is very high. It's a lot of hours in the practice room. And I tell people none of that has changed, but what has changed is everything around it. And so the things that you need to do, you know, as a communicator, as somebody who understands and can talk to audiences and find audiences and program for audiences, do all those kinds of things, I think you're finding it whether you're running your own chamber ensemble or, frankly, if you end up in a major orchestra. But, you know, I tell people that if you're lucky enough to win a job in a top orchestra, and let's face it, few people will because it is so competitive – certainly a place like the St. Louis Symphony, and I think increasingly so a place like the Baltimore Symphony, your ability to be successful in the culture of that orchestra is going to go far beyond how you play on stage into your ability to do all these other things, interact,
yeah,
community
but in what
engagement.
Way, in what way? Because I mean, if you're, you know, sitting in the fifth stand second violins, I mean, it used to be you could have an entire career doing that.
Right.
Nobody noticed you, and you'd play for 50 years, you take your pension and call it a night. But now, I mean, people, it's not just the music director who's the face
That's
of
right.
the Baltimore Symphony, although Marin is certainly, Marin Alsop, a very good face of our orchestra here, but it's the players themselves.
Absolutely, it is, and increasingly so. And so I think part of our job is to teach people those skills in addition to teaching them to great players. And the reality is that whether you're in an orchestra or doing, you know, trying to put your own deal together, this is where I'm very optimistic, actually, about classical music, because I think the ways of reaching people, there are so many ways to reach people, if you think about that didn't exist 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I think
in
that's...
In terms of ways that they can understand
and
confront
access.
Music.
I mean, just think about YouTube. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great example of it. So I think to be able to leverage that and use that, you know, and not be afraid of it, actually, is where I think the great opportunity lies.
Mm-hmm. Are choruses doing the same thing? Because I noticed, for example, in Baltimore here, when you drive around Symphony Hall, there are banners hanging off of the light poles on the streets around Symphony Hall and the pictures of individuals in the orchestra. You know, Kathy Needleman, the principal oboist, or John Carney, the concertmaster. It's not just Marin, you know, but it's, you know, Jim Bowman, the timpani player. You have pictures of these people, and they're trying to create personalities of people that you hear and see on the stage. stage when you go to hear the symphony. Are choruses doing that kind of that same thing, or is it still mostly concentrated on the conductors?
No, I think exactly what Fred said. Choruses have to get out there in the audiences, and the thing about choral music is that it's a very, very intrinsically friendly community-based art form anyway. And so it's not, from what I understand from my colleagues in the orchestra world, it's not as hard to get the singers out there mingling with their audiences and to get the audience singing, which, you know, give them a chance, audiences will sing. choruses
are... Again, it's that participatory thing. And Fred mentioned this rusty musicians thing. These are people, you know, who played the clarinet in high school or in college. They play the oboe, they play the cello, and all of a sudden they take a week off work and they come to Symphony Hall and they sit next to a cellist in the cello section of the Ballroom Symphony, and Marin Alsop conducts them in a concert, and it's thrilling. It's fun. But it's doing, you know? The people who are doing it, it always seems to us, from my perspective, having tried to sell classical choral music now for 40 years, that there's a whole group of people who want to do it, who like to sing and like to be part of the stuff on the stage, but those people don't necessarily translate into people who will purchase tickets and come to hear the professionals do it themselves.
Oh, interesting. Well, we actually found in some research that Chorus America's been doing that isn't so true anymore, that there are choral singers.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah,
that's great.
Choral singers will go hear other choral music concerts. Now, they might not go hear, like, their next-door neighbor's concert, but, like, a touring choir or whatever, but they do. And pretty much the majority of the audience will have had some sort of singing experience growing up in their lives. That's sort of inspiring.
And research actually in the orchestra will tell you that people that are engaged to go to orchestras tend to have studied an instrument and played an instrument.
Right.
And so I think there's definitely a personal connection. You know, what's so interesting about this and I'm always struck by the fact that things really do come full circle. Because when you think about, you know, how people interacted with music 200 years ago, 150 years ago, is very different from the way we think about the concert experience today. You know, there was much more performer-audience interaction. It was much more casual in many ways. It had much more variety, actually, than you might see on a typical concert today. So I think we got to a point somehow where we elevated all of this. It's wonderful in many ways, but in doing that, I think we lost some of the almost populist aspect of what music is. I mean, people used to sit and they used to learn to play symphonies and they played duet, you know, on the piano. And in the 19th century, people had pianos and that's what they did. That's how they learned about music. And I think there's something that somehow we got away from there. And I think part of our job is to bring people back to that.
Sure. And this conundrum of education is interesting to me because many people in arts organizations across the landscape of all arts, visual art, dramatic art, literary art, complain that there's less and less arts education in public schools and even in private schools because people are so concentrated on testing. Yet there are more people studying instruments, taking private lessons, and more kids singing in children's choruses now in the United States than ever before. So there are people seeking these opportunities out even if they're not offered in the schools. Mm-hmm. As somebody once said, you know, you're not born loving Debussy. Mm-hmm. So how do you become a lover of Debussy? You become a lover because you sang in a chorus or you played in an orchestra as a kid. Talk about the rise of children's choruses because that's a big dimension of the Chorus America membership.
Yeah, it sure is. Actually, children and youth choruses tend to be some of our largest and most sophisticated organizations in the whole field. There was a big movement in the 90s, I think, where they really blossomed as soon as, it corresponded with the decline of music education in the schools.
Yeah, parents were seeking out these opportunities for their kids. They couldn't get it at school,
Absolutely.
So they were supporting nonprofit 501c3 organizations who would fulfill that need.
And it's interesting now what Chorus America is being asked to do is provide more guidance and more models, showcase some wonderful programs that are actually connecting back to the schools through these children and youth community choruses. And, you know, one little hop, skip, and a jump from an El Sistema-based program, like as in Venezuela's program, there are choruses that are really headed that way to get back into the schools, take some of their resources and bring it back, not to supplant music teachers, but to partner while a program is building or developmental in a school district.
And Fred Bronstein, you had a symposium that you hosted at Peabody a few months back, and Jesse Rosen, who's the head of the League League of American Symphony Orchestras, said that orchestras have to stop thinking of themselves as simply being in the business of giving concerts. Mm-hmm. And the Baltimore Symphony is a perfect example with this Orchids program that they have based on what Catherine just mentioned, mm-hmm. El Sistema, mm-hmm. this Venezuelan way of involving kids in classical music. That's quite a dramatic departure from, you know, the central mission of typical symphony orchestras.
It's absolutely true, you know, and I think it is. But I think it's the key point, because I think what it tells you is that people want to have different experiences in different ways. And I think one person's experience with classical music is going to be listening to a complete Mahler symphony and relishing it. Somebody else's experience may be very different. It may be a 20-minute interaction, you know, and I think we have to think of ourselves as being flexible enough as artists, and prepare artists to be flexible enough to really accommodate that.
Yeah. Let's take another break and listen to a little music. This is now the Choral Arts Chorus singing on their own. This is a wonderful spiritual arranged by the great spiritual composer and arranger H.T. Burley. This is called My Lord, What a Morning. The full chorus of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society music of H.T. Burley here on Choral Arts Classics.
Oh,
music of H.T. Burley. It's a wonderful spiritual called My Lord, What a Morning. The Choral Arts full chorus sang in that recording of a live performance that we gave at the Basilica of the Assumption in Baltimore last month, a concert that was broadcast right here on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Choral Arts Classics. My guest this evening, Dr. Fred Bronstein. He is the dean of the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University, and Catherine Dehoney. She's the president and CEO of Chorus America, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome again to you both, and thanks for being here tonight. Fred, before we go any further, I want to talk about this series of Dean's Symposiums that you are convening throughout the year. You've already had a few of them. The next one is coming up next month on the 22nd of February. It's a Monday afternoon, 2:30. Howard Herring is going to talk. He's the president and CEO of the New World Symphony.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a great example. One of the purpose of the Dean Symposiums was I was looking for a way to, in a sense, sort of open up Peabody, you know, let the light in a little bit more, bring in folks from around the country and around the world to talk about what's going on out in the classical music world. And to really, you know, sort of help us internally generate the kind of enthusiasm and the culture you want to generate for this kind of thing. And so we have Claire Chase is coming, and Howard, of course, is coming. And
yeah, Claire's a terrific flute player, a MacArthur Grant Award winner who runs a thing called ICE, the International Contemporary Ensemble.
Yeah, very creative. And so Howard, I was interested in because, of course, he's the CEO of the New World Symphony, and New World is it's a really good example, I think, of what's happened. When they started 25 years ago, it started as we're getting folks ready to be – it was the transition from graduate school to a professional orchestra gig.
Michael Tilson Thomas had this idea to sort of act as a minor leagues or a training program for a professional symphony orchestra.
Exactly. There are two of like it in the country. There's New World and then the Civic Orchestra, which is part of the Chicago Symphony, which I also ran many years ago. In New World, what's happened in the last, you know, I would say 10 years is it's evolved so that they are focusing more and more on the kinds of things we've been talking about, communication skills, technology skills, how to be more flexible, because they recognize that stepping into these positions, the environment is going to continue to evolve and change. And so they are putting as much emphasis on that as they are on the performing skills that they're also generating. They do a very good job of that. So and in fact, you know, in running the St. Louis Symphony, I had a number of New World graduates in, and they came in with this orientation, you know, of having these experiences and expecting to interact and be part of, you know, participate in that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Catherine Dehoney, so much of the challenge that arts organizations across the landscape of the fine arts face, and this is true for museums and dance companies and, you know, all sorts of artists, is relevance. This notion of connecting to the community. The folks at the BSO, the Baltimore Symphony, Maren Alsop, the music director, Paul Meacham, the executive director, talk constantly about connecting and being relevant in the community. What are choruses around the country doing? Are there any particular initiatives that they're ginning up that strike you as being particularly effective and interesting?
Yeah, you know, it's one comes right to mind. The Mendelssohn Club in Philadelphia, Alan Harler's group, had some award-winning commissions that were site-based in areas of Philadelphia where you would never, in your wildest dreams, expect a chorus.
Yeah. So they're doing these concerts not in a concert hall,
right,
but in armories.
Big armories. What was the latest one? Not a quarry. A waterworks, that kind of thing. And it's really bringing audiences out, and it's highlighting areas of the city that are important to the city. And so they're reaching out to their community that way, sort of through site-based works that sort of build off the site. It's not they're bringing Brahms into these spaces. So that's one way. Another way is to really link arms with other organizations within your community and involve them in your performance in all sorts of different ways, whether to actually perform, say, a dance group or a hip-hop. I know Vocal Essence out in Minneapolis is doing a lot with hip-hop artists and Latino bands and mm-hmm. things like that. And to really think very creatively about your programming. And I was at a concert recently where the conductor had broken up Poulenc Mass across the span of the concert. They didn't stand and perform the Poulenc Mass. They broke it into five segments and
did other stuff in between.
And did other stuff in between that really spanned a repertoire that could really reach the community and mm-hmm. So and they're trying to make it much more engaging visually.
Yeah, so it's reimagining what the notion of going to a classical concert is. And Fred, a lot of this, I think, at this juncture, when we've gone through this incredible explosion of institutional growth in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. We're spending billions of dollars on these edifices, these gigantic opera houses, these gigantic halls. Part of our problem is scale. I mean, it's ironic that musicians are facing problems with scales. we've all faced them in the practice room, but now we're facing them in the marketplace. For the Baltimore Symphony to sell out a concert, there are 2,465 seats in the Meyerhoff. That's a lot of folks to come to one night of shows, especially if you're repeating that night four times in a weekend.
Look, there's no question about it that when you think back to the evolution of symphony orchestras in this country through the 60s and 70s and 80s, as orchestras were expanding and seasons were expanding, that one of the fallouts from that was that orchestras, in some cases, grew to a position that they really didn't have the market to accommodate. And so I think – and expectations were set around that. So I think to some extent there's been some right-sizing going on, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think you're right. You know, we've built buildings and expectations at a scale that is hard to sustain in some cases. And so I think part of this is right-sizing and a combination of right-sizing and being creative about how to reach people in new and different ways. You know, and that's why I think of something like Le Poisson Rouge in New York City, which is a
nightclub.
Nightclub. Mm-hmm. Basically a nightclub for classical music, crossover. And it's the two guys that started it, actually, that were supposed to come in the fall. They're coming to do a Dean Symposium in the spring at Peabody. And I wanted them because it's a great story about, you know, this very thing, informal interaction with the artists, you know, doing other things, being able to hang out while you're listening to music. It's a different experience. But it's no less legitimate experience than you might have at a traditional concert hall.
Sure. I think one of the things that choruses have done very well is that they have been making people aware of the importance of community.
Yes.
And the communal experience of hearing music. That's the thing that I think, at least, will save live classical music. I mean, you can hear anything you want in your earbuds. You know, you can grab it off YouTube or Spotify, and then there's this whole other discussion about who's not getting paid for that. But there is something about hearing music in a concert hall with other people that cannot be duplicated in your living room or your car or your earbuds. And it's this connection to each other and the common experience. One of the best concerts I think we've ever given in the Choral Arts Society was right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And this was just a few weeks after 9/11. And there was even some questions to whether or not people would want to gather and be in a room full of 1,000 other people because maybe that was going to be a target. I mean, back in those days, it was a very fresh wound.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But people came, and it was important that we were there together. Choruses are very good at this in particular. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps better at it than orchestras have been traditionally.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we always say choral music, you know, we have words. And that helps because for events where you need to express what's pretty inexpressible, combination of music and words together can really tie folks as a community.
Yeah, so people can relate to the poetry
exactly.
as well as the musical
but
setting.
It also speaks to being able to respond quickly to events in your community, and I think Baltimore did a great job with that. You know, with your troubles this year, the musicians were right in the thick of it, and choruses respond that way. And it is what they pride themselves on is helping a community feel.
That's interesting because it's an interesting point. You know, we talk about how classical music is challenged, and yet it's. You know, we should remember that it's the thing that people turn to.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you mentioned 9/11 or the aftermath of the riots in Baltimore. I think that it plays an enormously important role and people respond to it. And I've always felt that if we could just make that connection every day,
right.
then we'd really have something.
Yeah. And of course, the problem with the everyday connection in that is that these traumatic events really call for something extraordinary. They call for something different and special.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not going to have something different and special about yesterday's grocery list. And that's maybe what makes them so powerful is because they don't happen, thank God. We don't have the sorts of social ruptures that we had in 9/11 or in April 27th. But classical music has long had a challenge with snobism.
Yeah.
You know, where it's been thought to be, part of this rarefied educated elite in some way.
Well, I think it's where you saw the separation, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, where it started to peel away from popular music, when it was synonymous with popular music. I mean, you know, you think back to the 19th century. I mean, Paganini and Liszt were rock stars, basically, of their time. Yeah. And that changes in the 20th century, and you start to see this bifurcation between popular and classical music. And I don't think that was good for classical music, frankly. We did it to ourselves.
Yeah, it's the Grey Poupon problem.
Yeah. Yes. You know, right.
Where the Rolls-Royce window comes up, pardon me, do you have any Grey Poupon? That all be plays in the background. You know, well, you know, why can't you have hip-hop in the background while you're eating Grey Poupon? I love Dijon Mustard, you know, and I love hip-hop, too. But, Catherine, the choruses around the country that are really making an impact really are doing things much differently than or much different than just giving concerts.
No, that's absolutely right. And when I think of, you know, like Conspirari or those kind of groups that are morphing.
It's based in Dallas.
In Austin, Texas. Texas. Craig Hallett Johnson's the director, and they literally morph almost all the time. Their concerts have popular music and folk tunes and spirituals and classical. And I think that's been very engaging for folks, sung at an incredibly high level.
Yeah, we launched just this year, in addition to the Dean Symposiums, these called Dean's Incentive Grants, which are, we're giving to selected faculty and students. Anybody can enter it in Peabody to submit ideas, innovative ideas about, their, you know, use music in the interdisciplinary space, in the community, access. And it's been really fascinating to see some of the ideas that come out of it.
That is fascinating. It's like a little classical music R&D.
Exactly. That is exactly what it is, which is what we ought to be doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this has been a terrific conversation. I'm grateful to you both for your time this evening. And thanks so much. And break a leg with all your next projects.
Thanks for having us.
And congratulations on 35 years.
That's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, for folks who haven't heard, I have announced that I'm going to be retiring as the music director of the Choral Arts Society after next season. So you're stuck with me for another year and a half. But by the end of 2017, there will be a new music director who will be as blessed as I have been to be the steward of that great organization. So thank you both. Fred Bronstein from the Peabody Institute here in Baltimore and Catherine Dehoney, the president and CEO of Chorus America in Washington, D.C. We're going to hear one more tune now. This features the Choral Arts Society Chorus and Orchestra, a very famous song by Johann Sebastian Bach. This is from Cantata 147, Jesus bleibet meine Freude in German, often translated as Jesus, Joy of Man's Desiring. Music of Bach here on Choral Arts Classics. music by Johann Sebastian Bach, one of his most famous movements from Cantata 147, Jesus bleibet meine Freude, often translated from the German as Jesus, Joy of Man's Desire. We heard the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society in a live performance recorded last month at the Baltimore Basilica. I'm Tom Hall. I conducted that concert on 88.1 WIPR. This is Choral Arts Classics. Let me tell you about a couple of cool events coming up later this spring. On Sunday afternoon, March 20th, we will celebrate 50 years of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. My predecessor, the founder of Choral Arts, Theo Morrison, will be with us. He'll conduct some of his own music, including a couple of movements from his Canonic Mass, as well as a movement from a piece that he commissioned his music director way back in 1975. It's by Theo's and my great friend, Norman Scribner. Norman passed away last spring, and we will remember him when Theo conducts the full chorus and orchestra in a performance of a movement from his beautiful cantata, The Nativity. We are also very excited about sharing with you the world premiere of a new piece that we've commissioned from James Lee III. He's a terrific composer whose music has been performed by choruses and orchestra around the world, including our own Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. He also serves on the faculty of Morgan State University. He has composed a wonderful new work for a cappella chorus called Hallelujah, with a Hebrew text interpolated in and out of the word hallelujah. James's hallelujah is one of the three settings of that word that we'll include on this special 50th anniversary concert. We'll sing a setting by Randall Thompson, as well as a treatment by J.S. Bach from his motet Lobet den Herrn. The centerpiece of that concert is one of the great classics of the choral canon, Mozart's beloved Requiem. It's going to feature Janice Chandler Ateme, Krista River, John Wesley Wright, and Kevin Deese as our outstanding solo quartet. Festivities will all conclude with members of Choral Arts past and present joining us in a rousing rendition of Handel's Hallelujah Chorus. So to connect with details about the concert, please stop by baltimorechoralarts.org. Again, the big anniversary concert is Sunday, March 20th at Krauser Auditorium on the campus of Goucher College. Looking forward to April. Our annual Ruby Cabaret takes place on Friday night, April 15th. Jennifer Sheehan is our featured performer. She is one of the hottest acts on the New York cabaret scene, and we look forward to hearing her sing. The Choral Arts Chamber Chorus will sing a few tunes as well. You can visit baltimorechoralarts.org for all the details. Also, when you come to baltimorechoralarts.org, you can order Choral Arts CDs, including Christmas at America's First Cathedral, which we recorded at the Baltimore Basilica, as well as a recording with jazz legend Dave Brubeck. That'll do it for us tonight. Thanks again to my guests, Fred Bronstein of the Peabody Institute and Catherine Dehoney of Chorus America, and thanks to you for joining us. You can hear Choral Arts Classics on the radio or on demand. Go to WIPR.org and catch up on shows that you may have missed or shows you'd like to hear again. The producer of Choral Arts Classics is my good friend Luke Spicknall. I hope you'll join me in the morning for Maryland Morning. I'm looking forward to a conversation tomorrow with Nick Mosby, the councilman from Baltimore's 7th District who's running for mayor. I'll also check in with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. That's all coming up tomorrow morning on Maryland Morning at 9 o'clock, right after Morning Edition here on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall for WIPR and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you in the morning for Maryland Morning and next month right here on Choral Arts Classics.